and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am still not Tyler Smith. I'm still almost as good, editor Lars Scott Nye.
I remain David Bax, and Tyler remains out of sorts, out of commission. If you want to know what's going on with Tyler and how you can help, you can go to caringbridge.org/visit/Tyler and Jennifer Smith. There are somewhat weekly or every other weekly updates about Tyler's condition and his slow progress. And there's also a link there to the GoFundMe, because this sort of ongoing serious medical catastrophe that Tyler has gone through is very expensive in this country. And you can help Tyler and his wonderful family by throwing some cash at the GoFundMe. So please do that. Sticking with sad news, Scott, I don't know if you'll have any thoughts on this, because I know, look, Scott, when it comes to popular music, Scott, I think of you as someone who has good taste, but not as adventurous maybe as your taste in movies.
No, I'm very middle brow when it comes to music, and I don't mind owning up to it.
Yeah, but I definitely don't think of you as a hip hop person at all.
No, I'm very square when it comes to music as well.
Yeah, I don't know if you're aware that the rapper Takeoff from the I guess formerly of the group Migos, they had I guess only somewhat recently stopped performing together as a trio under that name, was shot and killed the other night in Houston.
I did hear about this.
And it's very sad. But I'm not going to say any reason it's not sad. Not only is this sad, but it seems to be part of a trend that has exacerbated in recent years. A lot of them here in Los Angeles. This was in Houston, but a lot of people here in Los Angeles, like Draco the Ruler was killed last December, a few years before that, Nipsey Hussle, somewhere between there, Pop Smoke, a lot of rappers keep getting killed, and it's really sad. I don't know what to say about it, except that, like, I'm heartbroken every time it happens, and it happens enough that I'm getting angry that these artists who are so promising and so young. I mean, Takeoff was only 28. Draco, when he died last year, I don't know how old he was, but he was clearly on the precipice of becoming like one of the new big names in rap, especially from the West Coast, from Los Angeles. And I just, like, it's anytime a celebrity dies, especially when they die in such an awful way, it's sad and terrible, but this ongoing pain of losing rappers to violence is really it's really been gutting me lately, and I don't know what to say about it. I certainly don't know what to do about it as a a white, mostly outsider to the hip hop world. But I guess I want people to understand that it's happening, and that it's not okay. I don't know if it's like because maybe like some of the biggest, you know, if you came of age, like at the time that you and I did, Scott, we remember like Tupac and Biggie, sure, both being murdered within a year or so of each other. And I think there is maybe from a white outsider standpoint, a maybe condescending way to say, like, to think like this, well, that's just what happens. And it's not like it's that sort of dismissiveness or lack of major attention is dangerous, but also it hurts me is not as much as the death of these rappers, but it just feels like there's so many different parts of this, of our society and culture, that are behaving in the wrong way to let this keep happening.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, it's ironic that the only time I ever hear about these people is around like them dying of drugs or violence or whatever the case is. And it seems like it happens. It does feel like it happens all the time because I don't know if I feel it more or less for that lack of familiarity, but I feel like I'm constantly hearing about these up and coming hip hop acts because someone in them died.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, those the ones I've named are just ones that were already like big names. There's like just a couple months ago, there was a guy here in Los Angeles who I think wrapped under the name PNB Rock, I think was his name. And he was like, not a big name, but maybe up and coming. And he was, at a restaurant with his girlfriend and she took a Instagram picture of them. And I guess someone on Instagram saw his chain or his watch or something and was like, and just like went to the restaurant and shot him dead in the booth and took it. And like that, I don't know why that kind of violence against rappers is allowed to thrive. You know, no one's, I don't know. No one's stalking. No one's going up and like shooting Beck or something because of his Instagram. I doubt Beck's on Instagram. I don't know. Or Scientologists a lot on Instagram.
I'm sure he at least has an official Instagram. Well, I like not to use my own experiences like the be all end all, but I would wager that Beck is a more famous and slightly more insulated artist than whoever you just named.
Yeah, PNB Rock maybe is not, but I feel like Migos were huge, obviously not to you, someone who doesn't follow hip hop, but like.
But it's also not like I'm not seeking out Beck either. I've just heard of Beck because I exist in the world and Beck has been around forever. And like,
right.
I'm forced to know who Beck is. I don't care if I know who Beck is or not. Somebody just made me know who Beck is at some point.
But my argument is years. Someone who has the same general relationship to music that you do, but is 15 years younger than you are, probably knew who Migos were, is what I'm saying.
That might be, but I think I'm more speaking like the idea of insularity and accumulated wealth, where like, okay. I doubt Beck's going out and hanging out in diners and Instagramming about it either. Probably not even going out to hang out in diners at all at this point. And I'm not sure my point is in there. Well, as far as you saying like, how it's allowed. I mean, it's the same way that any degree of violence in the country is allowed. We just allow it. Like there's violence perpetrated against far more vulnerable people in this country than rappers. And, you know, people aren't okay with it in theory, but we do kind of just allow it. So the idea that it would, I don't know. I don't know the circumstances under which a lot of this happens. So the idea that it would more especially happen to one group purely for societal reasons, I don't know. I think it's just anybody's allowed to kill anybody pretty much. And like,
I don't know about allowed
in a larger sense. Yes. There's nothing really stopping them. Like they'll get their punishment. And I'm sure a lot of people who commit these violent acts do as well. But like, that's not disallowing the act itself. The act's still done and anybody can go do that. You know, someone could walk into my apartment right now. I'm on a pretty public street, Hollywood wise. And not in a building super secure. So, you know, there's nothing in the society that's disallowing this kind of stuff.
Well, I don't. It's just, I don't. I guess I don't have any more thoughts on it other than it's break my heart. To someone who loves music and, you know, feels about like music that has made me feel something strongly, like any art. I develop a connection to it, and to see to see this keep happening. By the way, you mentioned like not really knowing much of the circumstances around it, I would recommend to you and to the listener if you have time, seek out a Los Angeles Magazine article from this past January, written by Jeff Weiss called The Assassination of Draco the Ruler. It's kind of long, but it, it goes into the actual events of what happened to Draco the Ruler, but also kind of the bigger landscape of how difficult it is, especially in Los Angeles, to make a name as a rapper without the influence of like organized crime violence. It's really fascinating and sad and sobering story. Yeah, that's a Los Angeles magazine. Anyway, I guess speaking of music, I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. Tyler and I generally use them each and every day of our lives. Today, and actually a couple times over the past couple days, speaking of people who die, but at least this one isn't, you know, cut down in his prime. Patrick Haggerty, who was known or recorded under the moniker Lavender Country, died recently. But he was back in the early 70s making country music that was explicitly, sometimes even aggressively queer. way ahead of his time in that way that he's doing. In like 1972, 73, he was doing like legitimate old fashioned country music aimed at a country audience. But, you know, one of his, the song I've revisited the most times over the past few days, is called Crying These Cocksucking Tears. And like, that's funny. And he knows it's funny, but it's also like in the tradition of like, beautiful, like, jilted lover ballads, and it's actually a really strong and beautiful song that also is has the word cocksucking in it a dozen times. Anyway, check out Lavender Country if you didn't know about them. R.I.P. to Patrick Haggerty, and it'll sound great on your tweakedaudio.com earbuds if you they're available at a low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Scott?
Yo.
Let's get into it, shall we?
Absolutely. Back,
even though I don't quite know what it is, like J.K. Simmons at the end of Burn After Reading. I don't know what we did.
I reference that scene so often at work because like sometimes things will just solve themselves.
Yeah.
And people will look at me like, okay. And I'll be like, so I guess we learn not to do it again.
So I know I've been talking a lot, but I'm going to continue talking because this is a sort of subject. And as of us recording this, you listeners might be able to look down at your MP3 players, your Zunes, whatever you have, and see the title of the episode. Right now, I don't know what we're calling this. Hopefully we'll figure it out.
We'll say some phrase in the course of this and be like, that's a title.
So, but it's something I've been thinking about a while because it's made me go back and forth on like feeling a sort of like imposter syndrome.
Okay.
But then also feeling haughty or looking down at other people at the same time, like, or not at the same time. It's often back and forth. So here's what I'm trying to say. There is, I would say, a certain breed of cinephile of which I most of the time am.
Sure.
I have occasionally referred to them as the fuddy-duddies. They tend to be more drawn to classic film and art house film.
Mm-hmm.
Cerebral things. And even, you know, when they do like more mainstream stuff, it gets, I know it's been over a decade since we had the whole discussion about vulgar auteurism, but I think the kind of way of seeing movies that that came out of, which I never liked that term. I do think it occasionally has its uses, you know, like alt comedy. I don't know if anyone says alt comedy anymore, but that was a term that I always hated, but occasionally it's like, that's a good shorthand for, for what I want to refer to.
Yeah. I mean, it's like anything, once it gets mainstreamed, it's like, well, it's not alt anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So I generally, I'm aligned with these people. These are the people you and I have talked about, you know, this is a whole other conversation that we've actually had years ago with Jake Barton and Kristen Sales on the podcast, when we were talking about the idea of film Twitter and the idea that film Twitter already is the specific niche of Twitter, but there are so many niches within film Twitter.
Big time.
So sometimes I think when you and I shorthand film Twitter on this podcast, what we're talking about isn't necessarily everyone else's experience of film Twitter, sure. You know, but when you and I talk about film Twitter, we are often talking about the kind of people who, let's say, love Michael Mann movies.
Yep.
Generally love James Gray movies.
For sure.
Is a big one. That sort of, you're definitely guilty because he's great, but you're a big Hong Sang-soo fan. I think he would kind of fall into that, that category of, and I tend to be that kind of film goer. But then there are certain directors and certain films that really seem to repulse that kind of film fan. And I usually like those. And I would say I started thinking about this late last year, early this year, because among those members of film Twitter, of the cinephile world, there was a big pushback against David Lowery's The Green Knight, a movie that I liked quite a bit.
Yeah.
And so I was in my first reaction was a bit of like defensiveness, because I was like, oh, how, like, am I some kind of fucking loser or wannabe because I like this movie? Because that's always the first place I go. Is
the reason you and Tyler get along.
that self-doubt thing. But then I started, like, I put some distance and I started trying to figure out two things. A, what attracts me to these kind of movies? And I'll get into more what these kind of movies are. And B, what about them turns off that kind of cinephile? And I would say this, so we'll get into that in a second. Actually, let me get into what I mean by these kind of movies in this case.
Yeah.
Because I tweeted about this at the time, and I referred to movies like The Green Knight and Annihilation, and I think I even threw like Rogue One in there, which I know you're not a Rogue One fan, but I thought Rogue One was a pretty cool movie, and that's a big part of it. It's cool. I referred to them as bedroom wall poster movies.
Right.
That's the type of movie I'm thinking about initially. And then I'd kind of backburnered this until a week or two, about a week ago, as of this recording, there was a film Twitter poll about who's the most fraudulent contemporary director. And David Lowery was on there, which is why there was four directors. I'm struggling to remember the fourth one, but it was David Lowery, Rian Johnson, Ari Aster, and Luca Guadagnino. And I was looking at the films that, like, okay, David Lowery, they're clearly talking more about, I think to me, they're talking about more about The Green Knight than they are The Old Man and the Gun.
People always forget that one, weirdly.
Yeah. Ari Aster is, if I didn't vote in the poll, because I think it's a stupid question, but if I were going to vote, I probably would have voted for Ari Aster. He's the one of those that I'm least sold on, most skeptical of. I didn't really like Hereditary, and I liked Midsommar. Parts of it I liked a lot, but I don't think it's that great. But I understand, like, Rian Johnson, obviously he makes these kind of slick movies like Knives Out and The Brothers Bloom, and then of course he helmed a a Star Wars movie. The one I don't really get on that list is why those people also don't like Luca Guadagnino. Is that just contrarianism? Because like, I feel like it seems like Luca Guadagnino would be more in the wheelhouse of this type of film fan.
You would think so. I think your identifying these as bedroom wall posters is right on the money.
Okay.
Or bedroom wall movies, or whatever phrase you used. Because I think they make the kind of movies that got a lot of us into movies. And I think there's a reflexive turn against that initial impulse to be like, it's really just a sense of wanting to feel grown up. And like a lot of this kind of crowd of film Twitter is driven by people in their late 20s, maybe 30s, who really need to make a point of showing that they're older than the more developed than they were at 17. And they're not into those kind of movies anymore. That's kind of the closest through line I've been able to find to it in like both interacting with it on Twitter. And like, I talk to film Twitter people in real life, I think a lot more than you do, or at least this crowd of film Twitter. And in terms of like the conversations I've had with them, like the urgency with which they get out their dismissal of them, it comes from a stronger place than just like the course of conversation. It's like they really need to make a point to like show that they do not like these people and are better than their movies. And I mean, I have my own mixed feelings about the list looking at it now. You know, there's, I think all of them have been movies I like and movies I dislike, basically. And I think that's also a component too of like, usually these are people who came out of the gate with, and not Luca Guadagnino, which is one of the reasons why he's kind of strange in there, but kind of came out the gate with a strong first impression, and have been subsequently held to that impression, regardless of whatever else they do in that time. Because like David Lowery has made 4 movies or 5, I can't remember how many, but they're all
pretty. I count 5 real quick.
Okay.
Ain't Them Body Saints, Pete's Dragon,
yeah.
Old Man and the Gun,
Ghost
Story and Green Knight. Oh, yeah, that's 5. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's similarities there, but they're all pretty different. And so like I love A Ghost Story, kind of mixed on the rest. I really like Old Man and the Gun too. Kind of mixed on the rest though. And like you mentioned with Ari Aster, like didn't really like Hereditary, kind of dug Midsommar, but there seems to be like a somewhat streak of auteurism where like, okay, once I've made up my mind about this guy, and they're mostly guys, because I think also part of it is like a reflexive distaste of like the film bro crowd, which trust me, I get. The film bro crowd can be as tiresome as anyone.
But also this happens all the time with the internet, but like I feel like the word film bro used to have a very specific meaning, and now it's just like guys who like movies I don't. I like it feels like it's become more nebulous over time, whereas it used to be, I think, the guys who, I guess, to go back to bedroom wall posters, like dorm room wall posters, like the guys who had, you know, like I did, Trainspotting and Pulp Fiction, and I never had a Scarface poster, but that sort of thing, and thinking like the end all be all of cinema is this kind of pubescent boy focused work that feels important. I think that's okay. I've interrupted you, and I'm gonna let you go back. But I mentioned Annihilation, but Alice Garland is one who definitely seems to like piss these people off. And totally. I think a big part of it is that his movies are like so self-consciously like about things. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's the biggest unifying thing, is that like they're genre films that are very self-consciously about things. Maybe less so Luca Guadagnino, although he did make that Suspiria remake.
Wonder if, I keep cutting you off, I'm sorry, because I wanted to get this out earlier. Wonder if, I'm not sure how many people have even seen Bones and all, but I wonder if like that's a
driving it a little bit.
It's a preeminent strike, a preemptive strike against a movie that seems like it's definitely made for a certain kind of teen. you know, a late teen, like, goth romantic type, which is right up my alley. I don't have that self-consciousness. I've got plenty of other self-consciousness.
Lord
but
knows.
I'm happy to be unabashedly a fan of embarrassing teen
absolutely
stuff. Yeah
And I think the genre element comes into play, so like it's really, I mean, by genre we really just mean like sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and I don't know, I feel like there's a tone to the kind of movies that Rian Johnson makes that makes them different from like just saying a crime movie, because he doesn't make crime movies the way like Michael Mann makes a crime movie, to go back to like clearly a guy this crowd loves. But it's sort of like a little quirky, a little twee, if you like, even.
But I also think, and now I'm going to sound like I'm one of these fuddy-duddies, like I'm talking shit about Rian Johnson. I like a lot of his movies. But I do think they are the type of movies that flatter their audience in terms of like, they make you feel like you're smart for having watched them and kept up with them, you know, like Brick and Knives Out both have these twisty turning plots. And so I think certain types of audience members feel like there's some sort of validation of their intelligence, that they enjoyed something that seems so
right. And I think that's also the objection to like an Alex Garland, because his movies are very audience flattering of like, look at the themes you're engaging in, that's a good time at the movies. But like in reality, I mean, I like one of his movies. I love Annihilation. The other two, I could take or leave.
What was his? Oh, I didn't see Men.
It's got some moments. And that's what I'm saying. Like, okay, within any of these movies, and I think actually, like, of all people, do you know who the film critic Nick Pinkerton is? Because
mm-hmm.
He's like mostly totally one of these guys. But I remember hearing him on the Film Comment podcast, I think, talking about Darren Aronofsky's Mother. And Aronofsky's another guy that, like, kind of creates the same rise, because he makes semi-genre movies that are very forward about being about something.
Mm-hmm.
But he saw Mother and was like, and like clearly all the hosts were expecting to rip into something, because he can be very flower with his dismissals, which is sometimes a blast to listen to. But he was like, I don't know, it's got some moves. And like, I think about that line a lot, because like, yeah, I was watching Men and it like mostly wasn't working for me, but every now and again to be like, yeah, he's got some moves. And like, I think that's my big problem with a lot of these dismissals, is that like, there's an expectation that because a film is attempting to be a grand statement on whatever, that it necessarily has to achieve that in order to be good. And sometimes like, it's kind of thrilling to watch someone kind of grapple with something in a slightly immature and half formed way, but in a very aesthetically exciting way. And I think like, for as much as like we like to think we've rescued aesthetics from being just like dismissed as part of film evaluation, I think they are still a lot of time dismissed. And like, I remember when Interstellar came out, I wasn't really looking forward to it because I didn't like Inception, I didn't like The Dark Knight Rises, but like P.T. Anderson was like, because he had Inherent Vice coming out, so he was just like in the press, he was like, man, I saw Interstellar and that shit rocked. And like, I saw Interstellar a few weeks ago, I was like, that shit does kind of rock. Like, no one can put together a freaking Titanic movie. And like, Dune last year was the same thing for me. It was like, I didn't really follow it entirely. I couldn't tell you about like the families and the clans and so forth and the history of the stupid world. And there are parts that were a little dull and stretching, but like, there's also stuff in there that's just like really freaking cool. And I think the like, that kind of base level response to just like, yeah, that is kind of cool, and I'm kind of glad I get to like see this at the movies, I think is easy to dismiss because it's kind of where we all come from in terms of first getting into movies, of just like responding to whatever like the initial sensation is and not really thinking about it after. And so there's a reflexive desire as we get older to be like, well, I can think beyond that initial sensation and say, well, the film's kind of empty, or this other film isn't necessarily giving me that initial sensation, but gives me a lot to think about afterwards, and there's a lot to talk about and a lot that it reveals. I think that's valuable too, but I don't think we should dismiss that. Like, it's cool to see some cool shit well achieved in movies.
Yeah, I mean, you're reminding me of 2017 at a New Year's Eve party. I got into a discussion with someone I didn't know who's a big Star Wars fan who hated The Last Jedi, and I liked The Last Jedi, and I was like trying to have a discussion with him, and I kind of realized at a certain point, like, I think we're just like speaking different languages.
Yeah.
Like, the stuff that you care about is completely immaterial to me, and the stuff that I care about seems to be completely immaterial to you. But then I do, like I said before, I do align with the Star Wars, some Star Wars people on Rogue One, which I know, you don't like as much, but that's one that I mean, as much as I try to resist, comparing a movie to the other movies in its franchise or whatever.
Right.
I think coming off of the perfectly good, perfectly serviceable Force Awakens, which has that kind of formless, gloppy, gloopy J.J. Abrams thing going on, and then to go from that to Rogue One, in which Gareth, I'm going to say Edwards, but it could be Evans.
I know, right? We do this every time.
Yeah. Like, right from the beginning, he returns us, I think, to that sense of scale and like, that the initial Star Wars had of, like, here's how much bigger than a person this ship is, and then here's how much bigger than this ship the planet is, and that kind of stuff was just like really impressive to me. Plus, I like, Tyler and I have talked about this subgenre of war movies that our college professor used to just call platoon movies, not referring specifically to platoons, but the idea of, like, there's a bunch of guys in a platoon at war, or a bunch of guys and girls, and they each have their own, like, one thing. Like,
right.
They each one is like, they're all two-dimensional characters, but by putting them all together, it's a fun buddy hangout, but with higher stakes. Like, Sands of Iwo Jima is a great one that Tyler and I are both big fans of. Sands of Iwo Jima, and Rogue One, to be blasphemous maybe to some people, reminded me of Sands of Iwo Jima.
I don't see why someone would consider that blasphemous.
I don't really know what the consensus on Sands of Iwo Jima is. I like that movie.
I've never seen it. Who directed that one again?
You know, I could probably tell you if you give me a minute.
The magic of the internet. Yeah. I think that's just an extrapolation of what I was saying. So I'm struggling to fill this void while you look up the director of Sands of Iwo Jima.
Wow, except his name is Alan Dwan.
Oh, well, talk about a guy who freaking Nebbish Film Twitter has really rescued in the past decade. People love Alan Dwan now, so they probably love Sands of Iwo Jima.
Okay. Do you want to guess how many directorial credits he has on IMDb?
I'm going to say 120.
Way more.
Because he came up in the silent era, so yeah, it's like, it could be anything.
But he was still doing, like, up until the end of his career in the 50s, he was still doing 2, 3, 4 movies a year. So he has 408 directed by credits on... a lot of these are silent shorts for years, exactly, and years here. But yeah. Okay. So Alan Dwan, maybe I should see more Alan Dwan, cause I like Sands of Iwo Jima.
Yeah. I mean, the stuff I've seen, I could take or leave. There's a segment of, classic film Twitter that's like, any movie about a group of guys is the best movie ever. And I could, I don't find groups of men all that appealing. mostly because,
oh wait, okay. He did, Slightly Scarlet, which I've seen, which is, an in color, noir movie with John Payne.
Oh no, I missed that. I know they Rhonda screened Fleming? It at, I think they screened it at one of the noir cities that I couldn't make.
I saw it. I saw Slightly Scarlet, many years ago, double bill at LACMA. It was the second half of a double bill. The first half was The Damned Don't Cry, which is a great, movie with, Joan Crawford, leaving her husband and sleeping her way to the top of an organized crime outfit. It's a fucking so awesome movie.
Which one of these people is damned, and did they cry or not?
Obviously, it's the code era, so she is damned, yeah, because, yeah, she left her husband and had sex outside of marriage, I guess. I don't know. But I don't think she cries. Maybe she does cry at the very end. I can't
remember. Well, then she lived up to the title. You get your money's worth.
Yeah. All right. We're way off.
Yeah, I was trying
Alan Dwan profile episode.
Thank God.
And he didn't make that. He made the other one.
Well, it was interesting. Oh, yeah. I remember one thing that you touched on earlier that I was going to mention, that like 15, 20 years ago when you and I were dorm room age, I guess more than that at this point, even, the posters were like Tarantino or De Palma or Danny Boyle.
Fight Club. Yeah.
The Adventure, totally. And so like those guys were like the kind of guys, they were like the freaking Ari Asters of the day or whatever, where the there was certainly a big crowd that was very dismissive of them and thought they were just like movies for adolescent boys, but the adolescent boys loved them. And 20 years later, they're like among the most revered filmmakers around, at least of their era. And so I wonder if, you know, the chickens will come home to roost.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That they'll come, that all this will come back around, and all the people who are, you know, getting turned on to movies for the first time through Hereditary or Annihilation or whatever, will both rescue the reputation of those movies, and those filmmakers will go on to make like either unqualified masterpieces or something that's more clearly like unifying, the way that David Fincher kind of did. Like David Fincher hugely dismissed by many years by such foolish people as our own David Bax. Until he made Zodiac, which is like a proper grown-up movie, and we could all like respect it kind of thing.
Yeah, and then I looked back a little bit, by which I mean I looked back at Seven and liked it, and I've actually watched Seven multiple times. I have not looked back. I still have only, I've seen Fight Club twice, didn't like either time, but it's been a long time. Saw The Game once, didn't like it. Saw Panic Room once, didn't like it. I'm sure if I revisited any of those three now, I would find more to like than I did when I was 19, 20, 21.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, like they're definitely like young man movies, and it's definitely like Fincher isn't all the way developed, but like you got some moves, man. There's like stuff in that movie that is just, in all those movies that are just awesome to watch. And I mean, I think part of, my reflexive distaste for this kind of stance of like these newfangled kids and their sensation based movies is like what it eventually takes for those people to get reconsidered. And David Fincher is a good example. And Paul Thomas Anderson is a really good example in that, like, oh, they made a period piece set in the past that's like about America, thus we can take them seriously. And it's like, well, like all the shit that was cool about There Will Be Blood or Zodiac was in their prior movies too, but they just weren't taken seriously because they were, I don't know, a little more instinctive, a little looser, little, and certainly more contemporary set. And, you know, my big rant about how devalued contemporary cinema in the sense of depicting the contemporary world is these days. But that feeds into it, is that like, there's not a strong cycle for rewarding and taking seriously movies that think instinctively about the present, because the present has to be thought of instinctively. Like the idea that you can come out with something that really completely encapsulates this moment in time that's always changing in the moment when we're making the movie is like almost impossible. It's a wonder it ever happens. And so I love that there are movies that like wrestle with the present as an active thing and try to come to some conclusion that might, by the time the movie comes out, be out of date or might be out of date in a couple of years. But like all that stuff about that people say about movies being dated or whatever, like that's the good stuff, man. Movies are like designed to be dated. So it's easy for an auteur to distance themselves from that and only make movies set prior to 1970, because we can think about prior to 1970 with much more clarity. We know what happened. We know the effects of everything that happened. And we have a sense of like what it meant for the country and society and mankind and whatever else. But it's much riskier to make a movie that is like, well, this is just how we live now. And we don't really know how we feel about it, but, this will kind of touch on a few impulses about it, and we'll see where we go from there.
I'm glad. I wanted to touch on a couple of things you brought up. The respectable, like period piece about America thing, doesn't say, you know, again, preemptively doesn't seem to be working for Damien Chazelle, who seems to be one of these people to these directors to a lot of people. I've liked Damien Chazelle's last two movies. I didn't really like Whiplash, but that's more about me being, not a fan of Miles Teller generally, sure, than anything else. But people seem already poised to dismiss Babylon, which I can't wait for. I'm stoked for.
No, I think it looks fantastic. Ironically, I would say the people who reflexively dislike Damien Chazelle liked First Man far more than any of his other movies. And I think it's a mix of, yeah, it's set in the past and it's a little bit easier to digest. And it's because it's somewhat, I think, because it wasn't a huge Oscar favorite that year. It was supposed to be, but it became an easy movie to be like, hey, you know, First Man, there was good stuff in it. And then you start like talking up the good stuff more than the bad stuff, which, I mean, that's a natural part of every awards season cycle. And we're all a victim of it to some degree or another, of feeling like something's overhyped or underhyped or whatever else. But because Babylon is returning to the entertainment industry, of which cinephiles are weirdly protective of to a degree I sometimes find uncomfortable, it does feel like, yeah, the knives are out again, to not overly reference Rian Johnson.
You know, maybe another thing that like might be just like a teaser for a future episode, maybe.
Sure.
But I wanted to like differentiate between like movies that are like explicitly about movie making and then movies that are more subtly and more obliquely about movie making.
Okay.
Because I generally am with the people who don't like movies that are about Hollywood, you know, or like, I have no idea, no intention of watching Paramount Plus's The Offer. Like that's the kind of like,
sure.
You know, masturbatory stuff I don't care about. I only somewhat recently, like for Halloween season, came to watch Jordan Peele's Nope. I didn't see it when it first came out, but so much of that to me is a movie about movie making.
Oh yeah,
about capturing images and the power of the image and what it does to the person or thing being captured in the image. I was so fascinated by that kind of stuff. This, like I said, this might be a tease for a future episode, the difference between like movies about movie making and movies about movie making.
Sure.
All right. So then the other thing you brought up was the idea of movies feeling dated, because that was one of the things I was thinking of, is like, what turns people off about these movies? And I've called these people fuddy-duddies. but they also, that, and I'm, like I said, I'm with them on most opinions. They also, like you did, loved Ambulance this year. This crowd sort of generally simply love Michael Bay's Ambulance, which wouldn't seem like it's their type, right? Because it's whatever. I'll actually get into that. And so I think, or I wonder if one of the things that turns them off about movies, like, to keep going back to The Green Knight, or Alex Garland's movies, definitely fit into this. Like Ex Machina definitely fits into this. That it is neither formally daring nor formally classical. So like Ambulance, you could consider it formally daring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, James Gray movies are formally classical, but because a movie like Ex Machina or Green Knight kind of like is neither, it's kind of like now-ish.
Yeah.
Those are movies that I think may very well in 15, 20 years longer look incredibly dated.
Or
but I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, because like Michael Mann's 80s movies look very 80s, but people embrace them, rightfully so, I think.
Well, I was going to say, or it just becomes the new classical, because like Michael Mann's a good example, Brian De Palma's a good example, where like they were very much making movies like of the now and in the style of their times, but which began to feel classical as soon as that style started to change. And it's the same reason why like Tony Scott got dismissed throughout his entire career until he died. I mean, Michael Bay, frankly, is a good example too, where like there's stuff in Ambulance that's like an acceleration of what he's been doing, but fundamentally he's still making the same kind of movie that he was 20 years ago. It's just that now we have enough distance to feel like we understand what he's doing a lot better and can appreciate it a lot more. I mean, it also helps too that Ambulance isn't self-consciously about anything too grand. I think it has a lot in it thematically, but it's not kind of shoving that at the viewer.
Yeah, I think it has a lot. I mean, most of my review of Ambulance was about its depiction, its snapshot of Los Angeles in the right here and now. I was going to say, but that's a good point, that like, but would you say, okay, I remember one of my, I didn't know, Godard. I mean, I knew of his name, but I didn't know him until film school. That's when I first saw Breathless. And then I also remember one of my film professors, who's an odd guy. I can't remember his name. I could tell you stories about him. Maybe I will someday. But he showed us clips from, or extended scene from two or three things I know about her, and then showed us, like, which is what year is that? 68?
67.
67. And then showed us, like, early 70s, like, commercials for, like, women's hygiene products and how much, like, and so, like, the commercials kind of followed Godard. And I do think there's maybe something to be said about people like David Lowery, Alex Garland going the other way, that, like, Ex Machina looks like, you know, an Apple product. You know what I mean? You know, The Green Knight looks like Terrence Malick filtered through Levi's ads and stuff like that, and then coming back out the other end. So maybe because they aesthetically do seem to be following, I guess you could say. I mean, often now this critique has old gray whiskers, but one of the most common critiques against filmmakers like Tony Scott was MTV editing.
I was just going to mention that.
Yeah. People get the impression, and maybe they're correct, that these filmmakers are following something that's already happened as opposed to blazing new ground.
Yeah. And I mean, David Fincher, Michael Bay, Spike Jonze, like, they all came out of the music video world too. So that there was a sense when they were first kind of crashing the scene of, like, oh, they're bringing music video aesthetics to filmmaking, and that was a bad thing necessarily. And I'm speaking as somebody who, like,
a good thing.
Right. I'm saying this is the argument that they're put forward.
Yeah. No,
I'm saying this as someone who, like, I don't, like, hate music videos, but I also rarely find that much value in them. Like, it's not like a judgment thing. They just don't speak to me really on any level. But I do think it's a good thing that, like, they were not only bringing those aesthetics in the first place, but figuring out ways to bring them into a feature format form. And I think critics at the time got really hung up on the fact of their presence without, like, thinking about the ways they could be extrapolated out into a feature form. And the fact that, like, those three directors in particular, and plenty of others more broadly, were doing that quite well and were thinking in feature formats even before they had that opportunity to kind of fully express them. And I mean, I think those same instincts still stay with them, as much as, like, David Fincher has been, like, resuscitated and is now one of the great modern auteurs. I mean, I mentioned my big thing with Mank when it came out is that a lot of people felt like it was a huge departure for Fincher. And I was like, if you look at his commercials, it's, like, got a lot in common with those. And so those impulses never entirely leave them. I mean, Tony Scott, a lot of his, what was tagged as, like, experimentations with camera speeds and stuff like that with Man on Fire and Domino was stuff that he was already trying out in commercials before he got them into features. And so that, I think that's the thing that people missed out on at the time, is that, like, no, the music videos were a thing, but it was really just a testing ground and a training ground for people who were already thinking in feature format form. It's just that we didn't have a language and a comprehension to appreciate that, or at least, you know, the generation who was defining what good taste was didn't. But obviously, you know, plenty of people who were 17 when Fight Club came out or whatever, like, it was their world and they were speaking its language, and that movie was speaking to them. And I think there's a reason why, like, when you first brought up this topic, I think I mentioned that, like, it does seem like this general critique comes against A24 movies generally a lot. And a lot of these directors have worked or have had movies distributed by A24. But for all the, like, annoying parts of the kind of A24 cult that have come up, the movies they release do speak to that generation really powerfully. And that's not worth it's worth taking seriously, and it's not worth dismissing, both because I think any movie or any swath of movies that has that kind of impact on an audience is worth taking seriously, but also because, again, in 10, 15 years, like, y'all going to look like the old guys. Whatever this thing is going to in some way be taken seriously because it's the people who practice within it will make some undeniable masterpiece, or the people who currently love them the most will come of age and start to define the taste. You know, it's weird to me now that like a movie like Marie Antoinette is like considered a modern masterpiece, because when it came out, man, people freaking hated that movie. I saw it twice opening weekend. I was in love with it, but I was a perfect age to be appreciating it. I was 20 and like the movie was talking to me and speaking my language. And now I'm just old enough to be part of a generation that was like, grew up loving Marie Antoinette. And that's the way cycles of taste have forever churned. I mean, that was the case with French New Wave directors in terms of what they liked. It was the way that the entire film noir genre got rescued. It's the way that like Michael Mann got taken seriously eventually. All this stuff eventually grows up with its audience, and its audience becomes the new tastemakers.
I should have been writing down all my thoughts, because I have thoughts on so many things you said. But to go in reverse order, I'll start with... No, I already forgot what the second one was. Oh, damn it. Well, what did I had it in my head, and I was... Oh, okay, I got it. Okay, so... the most recent thing that you said that I'll talk about is the movies that are dismissed by the people who are tastemakers at the time, but embraced by younger people, and then those younger people go up to become tastemakers.
Yeah.
A more recent one of those that Natalie and I were talking about, and we already mentioned Danny Boyle earlier, but Danny Boyle's The Beach is a movie. I think when that came out, people were like, this is stupid, this is ridiculous. And also there was still like, now everyone loves Titanic, but Titanic it was cool to not like, and so DiCaprio was a target at the time. And I feel like The Beach was not a movie that because it definitely I was gonna say it has that Alex Garland thing. Of course it fucking does. He wrote the novel. I forgot that as I was saying, but it does have that Alex Garland thing of being very obviously like about its themes,
right,
its messaging or whatever. But it's also just a cool fucking movie, you know? I don't know what happened to Danny Boyle. I haven't seen, I mean, Steve Jobs is okay, right? But that was like 8 years ago. What was the last thing he made?
I really like Steve Jobs. I loved Trance, the movie he made right before that.
I never saw Trance. 127 Hours was good, but what was the last thing?
I know, mentioning movies from before Steve Jobs. Oh, he made that movie Yesterday.
Oh, I didn't see
that. I didn't see.
That did not look like it was up my alley.
No, it does seem like... Did he make some other... Are you looking him up right now?
Yeah, he made directed a miniseries called Pistol that I think is... Oh, it's about the... It's a fictionalized telling of the Sex Pistols? Oof. I have no interest in that.
Yeah, well, Yesterday was his last feature film. Oh, he made, of course, the Trainspotting sequel.
I'm pretending it doesn't exist.
Did you see it?
I never saw it. No.
Okay.
The Beach is just an example of a movie that I think has very much had its sort of like reputation rescued by people like me who were in high school or just post high school. I think that came out the summer I graduated high school, like growing up and like, you know, now I'm 40 and I'm a man, I'm 40. and I can say, like when I say I like The Beach, I don't sound like a dumb kid
anymore. Right.
Have you seen The Beach?
I have not seen The Beach.
I can tell from your quietness that you maybe hadn't seen it. It's really
as much
cool.
As you talk about it, I do feel like I should. And it does seem like the kind of movie I would dig.
Okay. So then the other thing, two more things I wanted to talk about. The A24 thing, because here's what I don't like these young fuddy-duddies, as I'm calling them now, dismissing A24 out of hand, like you're talking about. I don't like that because the fact of their track record, it speaks for itself to me. They have put out a lot of good movies and some bad movies too, you know?
Yeah, it's such a broad brush.
They've
put out such a diverse slate that it seems insane to dismiss
it. Yeah, they put out a lot of movies, but what I don't like, where I am kind of sympathetic to the young fuddy-duddies is I hate A24 fandom, like people who are fans of A24. I remember being at TIFF in 2019, right? Yeah, 2019. And I was there to see The Lighthouse. And when the A24 logo came up, people applauded. And I got to tell you, I was sick to my stomach. I just hate that so much.
I mean, I feel kind of both ways about it. Like, they're getting people to see a lot of good movies. they're taking risks on a lot of strange movies, and they've come up with a financial model that's very flexible and very varied, sometimes in a way that's hard to track. And you're like, is this an Apple exclusive movie? Is this day and date with theaters and streaming? Like, which A24 trajectory are we on? But they, and so like, I'm kind of glad that people celebrate them and are recognizing that they've had a lot of success and have taken a lot of risks and get into that. Where it turns me off is like all the like kind of branded merchandise they put out. And it's like,
I think my thing is I have trouble differentiating between the two.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, I just don't like the same reason I like make fun of Disney adults. It doesn't mean that I think you're wrong for liking any one Disney movie or even liking going to a Disney park or whatever. But I just like bristle at the idea of being a fan of a brand.
Yeah. I mean, I would classify A24 as a little different than a brand. I think because that speaks to the idea that they've created such a unified idea aesthetic of what their movies are, when I think their output is actually far more varied. I mean, hell, you know, you and I adore Stars at Noon. That's an A24 movie.
Yeah.
But that's like leagues away from Midsummer or Men or something like that in terms of like what it's doing and how it's doing it. And I mean, everybody, including the young Fuddy Duddies, have movies from A24 that they love, and it's usually it just speaks to how widely varied their slate is. Yeah. But yeah, I think as soon as you start to make any element of that part of like your identity is where it gets dicey for me. And that's like where like the merchandising angle comes in.
Yeah.
Like, I, at various points in my life, could be lumped in with like the Criterion fandom through and through, but I never bought a Criterion shirt. I have the book they put out of like their artwork, but only because Ryan Gallagher bought it for me for a Christmas present. Like, I never bought any of that like Criterion gear or whatever.
Yeah.
And there's just
something. I don't have any Criterion gear. You know what I do have?
Yeah.
Because I got it for free this screening. I have a Wellgo Entertainment t-shirt.
I mean,
and I sleep in it. It's super comfortable. I like when they usually you get a free t-shirt. It's like it's a beefy tee. It's like all thick. This is a nice t-shirt. I wear it to bed often.
I mean, I would admire that just because who would be that big a fan of Wellgo of all people? Yeah. But like, so that's kind of like a cool move. But yeah, there's just something about like that extra level of like. And this is something that like I've always had going back to my youth, the idea of you just like walking around as an advertisement for whoever. I mean, I wear like plain t-shirts and button-up shirts for a reason. It's like, those are just regular clothes. I'm not like out here espousing for anybody.
Yeah. I mean, when I'm like dressed, I'm not either, but also all of my like stuff that I go on long walks in the morning. And I realized like I'm a walking advertisement then, because the shirts that I use for that are shirts that I've gotten for free usually, or like, sure. Yeah. So I'm like, yeah, Jimador tequila. That's what I'm out here advertising in the neighborhood today.
How do you have that shirt?
How? Yeah. Actually, I think Natalie and her friend one night went to like, they went to a West Hollywood like tequila crawl where they were like doing different shots of tequila at every bar. And I think it might have been sponsored by Jimador and they gave it to her and it was too big for her. So
nice.
So now I walk around the neighborhood and walk my dog in the morning.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even own like band shirts or anything like that.
I do have a Metallica shirt that I wear proudly.
Sure. I mean, I guess I have the Cinephile video shirt of Ingmar Bergman in the Iron Maiden font that I will occasionally wear. Julie custom made me a shirt with the title font from Alain René's Je t'aime that I will wear from time to time.
I've seen you in that. Yeah.
But, that's about as far as it go. I'm just also not, I mean, you know, I feel like I've gotten to an age where t-shirts wear weirdly on me now. But yeah, there's something about like the idea of like actively advertising for a brand. That's like, it's not my role.
Yeah. Okay, the last point I wanted to make, and this could actually be like, we could have an eye towards wrapping up now because we've been going for like an hour. You were talking about the guys most, yeah, those were all guys who came from music videos, or at least used music video aesthetic and brought into cinema. I feel like the newer wave of that is bringing social media aesthetics into cinema. And I feel like I can think of a number of like sort of bad versions of that, like movies made by people older than me for like cynically aimed at people in their teens and early 20s that are bad. I'm not going to name too many of those, but I wanted to try and think of what are the good ones. I feel like the first thing that comes to mind, and maybe this is the, finally we can, this is progress. We can talk about a female director, Janice Bravo's Zola.
Yeah. That's the big one that comes to mind.
But also now I've never watched Euphoria, but I saw Assassination Nation and Malcolm and Marie, and maybe Sam Levinson, who was, I don't know. Is Sam Levinson hated? I don't know where people stand on him. Love Euphoria, or do they hate watch Euphoria? I've never watched them.
I think because most of his fame has come through TV, there's just not as much engagement in there. I mean, I know Malcolm and Marie was really poorly received. I don't think an Assassination,
which is incorrect, by the way.
I know. I really like it too.
The thing, actually, I thought of Malcolm Marie earlier in the episode when you were talking about the idea of a director aiming for something, not quite achieving it, but that doesn't mean the movie's not good. Totally. I feel like Malcolm Marie is a great example of like part of what's fun about that movie is essentially it's two people on screen, but really it's Sam Levinson getting into an argument with himself and losing for the course of 100 minutes. Yeah. So I really like that movie.
Yeah. I mean, more and more, I like those kind of like movies that kind of struggle to figure out what they are. It's like, aren't we all doing that?
Yeah. Okay. So I think we figured it out. We put the young fuddy duddies in their place. Again, absolutely. I am a fuddy duddy, but not one of the younger ones. And we've rescued the reputation of bedroom wall poster movies, even though you and I don't see eye to eye on each one of them.
Well, no, I mean, that's,
but I also like... don't care. And I keep bringing up Rogue One, cause that's like a big point. It's a big, like, one you and I disagree on, but I also don't like Rogue One enough to go to bat for it. I just, like,
and yet here you are, going to bat for it.
Cause there's nothing I can think of that I know you don't like. I couldn't think of any other of these ones that I know you don't like. Any other, what bedroom wall posters do you not like? Bedroom wall poster movies.
I don't like, shoot. Oh, I don't know. I was just thinking of like the directors we talked about. I didn't like Knives Out.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I didn't like the Brothers Bloom, but I think that's the only Ryan
Johnson.
Didn't
care for the Brothers Bloom. I really didn't like the Northman. That's a definite recent big bedroom wall. Northman, the new Robert Eggers movie.
Yeah, I didn't actually dislike a lot of it. Was definitely the lesser of his movies, but I didn't really dislike it. I thought it was
A lot of the dorm room wall poster movies this year I have not been into. Like, I didn't really like Everything Everywhere All at Once. And I'm trying to think of other filmmakers in that swath. Well, there's a handful of examples for you anyway.
Yeah, there you go.
Although I did like Swiss Army Man a lot, and you and I are both big fans of Dick Long Is Dead.
Wait, is it Dick Long Is Dead? It's the death of Dick.
I always get that wrong.
Because there's Dick Johnson Is Dead.
That's what screws me up.
Yeah, I've done the same.
Dead thing. Dick movies.
I don't know. Coincidentally, I was just thinking of and laughing to myself at the death of Dick Long, the part when they're cleaning the blood out of the back of the car and talking about Pulp Fiction. They're like, oh, we could use a guy like the wolf, and someone, and the other guy goes, oh yeah, what's that actor's name? Anthony Kiedis.
We should do we should probably do this episode at some point before Tyler gets back, but it would be fun to do it with him, of movies about really dumb people, because I know Tyler hates movies about dumb people.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, I love movies about dumb people. I guess I don't know where you fall on that general idea. But
I don't know that I would say I love it, but I definitely don't have Tyler's like knee jerk. I think it's a case by case thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah. A lot of times I like them. Yeah. I think you should. I think I talked about this before, but I can't remember if you saw Takashi Miike's First Love, which was like 2018.
No, but I remember you talking about it. And it sounded really good.
That's another great movie about a couple of young dummies in love. By a gang war.
I don't know. I feel like an idiot for so much of the day, every day, that I'm like, finally, movies, you see me.
All right. Okay, so we figured it all out. That's it. What else will be rescued in the future? Will people look back at the movies of at Malcolm and Marie as a unheralded masterpiece in
50? Probably.
Yeah. All right. Well, you can find us at battleshippretension.com. You can find reviews of a lot of the movies that I just mentioned. I know I reviewed Malcolm and Marie. I reviewed Annihilation. I reviewed Ex Machina. I've been doing this a long time. I don't think I reviewed Steve Jobs. Did you? I can't remember.
Maybe I think did. I did, actually. That might have been for Criterion Cast, but I definitely went to a press screening of it.
So you can find all that at battleshippretension.com. You can email us at david@battleshippretension.com or tyler@battleshippretension.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @DavyPretension. Follow Tyler on Twitter at @TylerPretension. Also check out my other podcast, which is called The One Where I Met Your Mother. It's a podcast where my wife and I watch an episode of Friends and an episode of How I Met Your Mother every week and sort of compare and contrast and laugh and make fun and judge and do that annoying, you know, millennial SJW thing of pointing out what is problematic and has not aged well.
Finally, somebody is.
Yeah. Marta Kaufman cowered when she saw us coming. And David Crane and Carter Bays and the other guy who created How I Met Your Mother. I was trying to show off and I fell short on one of the four creators. Anyway, But this is a perfect time to jump in if you want to jump in at the beginning of the season, because we just started season 4 this week. So season 4, episode 1 of Friends, the one with the jellyfish, and season 4, episode 1 of How I Met Your Mother, Do I Know You? Which is the two shows we talked about this week, and you could follow along. What else did I say? Everything else? I think that's it for me. Scott, where can people find you?
On Twitter, if you dare, and on Letterboxd more easily.
Okay. Are you Rail of Tomorrow on both? Or
Yeah, that'd be good to point out. Twitter is Rail of Tomorrow. Letterboxd is just my name. I don't think I threw any initials in there. If you search Scott and I'll be around.
Okay. All right. Well, Scott, thank you for joining us once again.
Oh, it's always fun.
Thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.